Good morning from 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. And welcome to our election special candidates forum. As each Saturday this month, we speak to one candidate running for local or state office. The program is brought to you with support from Rebecca's Natural Food and Hamilton's at First and Main. Now here are your hosts, Bob McAdams and Jeff Leonard.
Happy Saturday, everybody. I'm Jeff Leonard, General Manager, 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
And I'm Bob McAdams, Special Events Coordinator at WPVC.
Today we're co-hosting WPVC Election Special, one of our interviews with candidates for Charlottesville City Council who are seeking the Democratic nomination in June 11th, on their primary. Keep in mind, WPVC does not endorse any candidates for public office. We provide this information to you, our listeners, to help you choose the best candidate.
With us in the studio this morning is City Council candidate Brian Pinkston. Brian, welcome to WPVC.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.
Brian, let's start by getting to know a little bit about you. You know, where were you born, and what was it like when you were growing up? What was your early life like?
So I'm a son of the Deep South. Virginia is the South, obviously the home of the Confederacy, but I grew up in the Deep, Deep South, a town called Albany, Georgia. And I grew up in a very politically and religiously conservative milieu. The sort of progression trajectory of my life has been to take my parents were fantastic people, are fantastic people, and they taught me to love my neighbor as myself and to care for others. But the way that has looked in terms of my political engagement has been a progression from again a very conservative perspective to now that's one that's quite blue. I mean, I think that the government has a very strong role in place to play in making our society more just and equitable. Yeah, so that's the world I grew up in, the Deep South. It was a small town, Albany, and there was a lot of in terms of the population, African American to white, it was about 50-50. So I was that was the world that I lived in. It was a great place to grow up, and it was interesting. Albany, I had a lot of business there because of the fact that Flint River was there, and there was a lot of natural groundwater, and so places like breweries and Procter & Gamble, which is a company I worked for, would come there because it had great water, and so you had this interesting mix of businesses that would come in, mixed with a very small town, and then a lot of agriculture surrounding it.
So, from the small town, where did you go for your education, what kind of education you have, and your job experience, how have those combined to prepare you to serve on City Council?
Yeah, so my undergraduate was in mechanical engineering at Georgia Tech. That was getting through engineering school, it forms your mind in a certain way to look at problems and break them down into their components, and then solve the components of the problem and then rebuild it. And so I went to Georgia Tech. I what they call co-opt. I would work. I would go to school a quarter, and then I would work at Procter & Gamble, the large mill in the city where I grew up. And I did that all throughout college. And my work experience at Procter & Gamble, there was a very large plant. We made, of all things, it's kind of funny, Charmin, and Bounty, and that was really a place that formed me because I was thrown in the middle of a whole range of personalities and people from different backgrounds, and I had been pretty sheltered when I was younger, and that was a great place for me to become unsheltered. So I did that while I was going to Georgia Tech. I graduated in 1994, a mechanical engineering degree. I loved all that stuff. I loved the math and the science. But at some point, I had always had this interest. My faith is important to me. I had this interest in going to seminary. And so when I was 30 years old, I took my wife. I had two kids at the time, and then a third was born out in California. We went to a seminary there for 3 years in Los Angeles. Which was a great experience. And then we came here to do a PhD in philosophy. And so I came here in 2004, finally got my PhD in 2012. So it was a really long, sort of brutal experience. And while I was at university working in graduate school, I worked pretty much the entire time full-time as a project manager in facilities management, using my engineering background. And so that's how we paid for school and got through school. So I have a deep love for the humanities. I have a deep love for thinking well, which philosophy helps you with. So I have this interesting background of just a very sort of technical skills and practical skills. And then, you know, I love St. Thomas Aquinas, Plato, you know, Aristotle, all of these guys. They really make my heart race. So
I was reading your website, and your website, what jumped out at me was exactly what you were just talking about, was your mechanical engineering degree and then a master's in theology and a PhD in philosophy. That's not a typical track that people that are science-minded tend to take. There probably weren't a whole lot of people like you with an undergraduate degree in that in your postdoctoral work or your postgrad work.
Indeed, yes,
that's
indeed.
Funny. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's City Council Candidate Forum. I'm Jeff Leonard, and here with us in studio today is Brian Pinkston. Brian, how have you been active in recent years to help improve Charlottesville?
So I've always been active in caring for the people around me. I was the way I was raised. But like so many people, just to sort of cut to the chase, in 2016, with that election, my heart was broken. I remember talking to my daughter after, you know, that November morning, and I was, this daughter, she's 19 now, I guess she was 17 then, trying to, like, console her with how that election turned out, and before I knew it, I was crying, and it just really struck me at that point that normal people, or at least people with my values, had to engage in civic life. There's a lot of good things you can do, from coaching basketball to being on a church committee to all of these things are important, but it is so vitally important that people get involved in their civic life, and that involves political engagement. So one of the things right off the bat I did, the local Democrats have this Road Forward PAC training, which was really good. It trains progressive candidates on everything you need to know to run a campaign. I did that. I helped Kellen Squire, who ran up in the 58th, on his campaign. I'm a co-precinct captain in Walker Precinct in the city with the Seville Dems. The other thing I did was I joined the board of Region 10, and that was a wonderful experience. The Region 10 Community Services Board, if you don't know what a community services board is, they're basically the backstop in communities. It's the way Virginia has it set up for people that are without the ability to pay for a substance use disorder, for developmental disabilities, and for serious mental illness. And so I was on the board of that for 16 months or so, and that was really where I began to see how I might be able to help in a place like city council. It's such an interesting, you're meeting with, working with volunteers, you're coordinating with professionals, you're dealing with the state at various levels, and also local municipalities. And so all of those things have sort of brought me to this point.
Region 10 is about a $35 million budget, so that's that's a pretty heavy lift. Running for city council is a huge deal. It also takes a lot of sacrifice, especially lately. Why did you decide to run? I guess, why now?
Well, part of it, in the previous question, I hinted at some of that. I think that and believe that our city is, you know, obviously there's been a lot of trauma over the last couple of years, and a lot of things that have, I mean, observant people already recognized a lot of the particularly justice and racial inequities. Those weren't necessarily hidden, but the last couple years have brought those things right up to the top, and you know that's long overdue. And I consider myself an activist. I have been I've done my share of, you know, die-ins or whatever on the Albemarle County grass when the ACA was about to be repealed and so forth. But all of the good work that's happened in the last couple years in terms of bringing a light to issues, I think it's time to take those good things and turn them into sustainable and real action. And I believe that I have a combination of compassion and empathy that resonates with those sorts of issues, but also a very practical and thoughtful, reflective approach to problem solving and to trying to find common ground with people. And so basically the end of last year, looking at who was planning to run for council and thinking that someone with my sort of managerial and practical background would be a valuable asset, and chose to run.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC City Council Candidate Forum. I'm Bob McAdams, and with us in the studio today is Brian Pinkston. Brian, the events of 2017, and you've alluded to them already, including the debate and the vote on the statues, the July 8th KKK rally, and the Unite the Right rallies, both on the evening of August 11th and August the 12th, as you said, they traumatized our community. They also uncovered covert racism embedded in our institutions. A year and a half has gone by. Where do you think we are now in race relations in Charlottesville, and where are we headed?
I think that we're headed to a better place. I know that that might not be popular with some people to say, but I think that light in seeing light being brought to topics and truths being said are valuable. Facts are stubborn things, and people have uncovered facts. And again, things that I think that were observant to the, I mean, I grew up in the Deep South, and the whole lost cause nonsense was something I was taught, you know, growing up. And I, as I frankly became more educated and came out of the Deep South, saw that that was, you know, BS, and rejected that a long time ago. And so, but what you've seen with, like, the studies that have happened at the university, the Commission on Slavery in Building the University, and the fact that university grounds, the subcontractors of the day were enslaved laborers, the new commission that they're doing on Jim Crow and segregation era, and all of the things that have been brought to light about racial zoning laws and so forth, those have been good. But again, I choose to be an optimist, and I'm canvassing all around the city, and I'm talking with lots of people, and this city is filled with people of goodwill. And many people that are, say, older in the city have heard, they've had their minds changed, for instance, about the statues. They used to think it was just, you know, nice artwork, but now they see the history, and they're much more responsive to you know, making those sorts of changes. If you ask me where I think we're going, I would hope that I think that we need to figure out a way. So the first part of this is truth. The next part, I think, is reconciliation. My faith tradition, and I think just common sense, talks about it talks about making amends, and it talks about admitting past mistakes, and then working towards reconciliation. And so that's where I hope that we're able to get to. That requires a lot of talk and dialogue in on both sides, and listening carefully, and particularly for a white male like me, it involves listening a lot and talking less. But again, I think the city's full of people with goodwill. I think if we can take the energy that we are experiencing and find constructive ways to move forward with it, that we're going to end up in a better place.
Now, there are many groups, and there's a lot of people in Charlottesville who are calling for more affordable housing, and that brings up related concerns about the racial biases in zoning and also gentrification. Now, which efforts by the city to increase affordable housing do you see as working and which aren't? And what further actions do you think the city should take to achieve that goal of getting more affordable housing?
I think that affordable housing, that whole topic is, I hear about it all over the city. It's at the top of so many people's minds, even folks that seem to live in wealthier neighborhoods. I think it's also the toughest nut for us to crack because there's so many factors involved in it. The in terms of people that are working on it, I think that the housing advisory committee that the city council has put together is doing a lot of good work. There are a lot of really intelligent people on that. There's a spreadsheet that they've identified basically 4,000 interventions that are required, and I like this word intervention. Because it's different than just saying you've got to build 4,000 units. So it's everything from vouchers to repairs to houses to actually constructing new places. So I think that that group is working on things that are going to eventually bear fruit. Obviously, a huge part of that is finding the revenue to fund these things. So that's a critical piece. Habitat is doing a great job. I don't think you could ask for a better partner to actually move forward in ways that are practical and productive. You know, the thing about home ownership is so many white families throughout the decades were able to build wealth through equity in their homes. And that wealth then let them be able to help their children go to college and so forth. And other, particularly African Americans, have not had that chance. So that's why building homes, the things that Habitat is doing, for instance, is so important. A person can invest $1,000 in a down payment for a home, and then that sets them on the path of wealth creation, which is so important. The other thing I want to point out is just our existing housing stock, West Haven, Crescent Hall, places like that. They need immediate attention, and to me that's a social justice issue if there ever was one, because we have people living in places that are really not fit to live in, and so I would see that as sort of the top of the list.
You know, higher pay would make housing and everything else more affordable. The Orange Dot Report shows the stark difference. The differences in income from one area of the city to another, often in parallel to racial divides. How do you see the problem of economic inequality, and what should the city do about it?
Right. So Charlottesville has a problem that many university towns have, and the fact that we're in the South and we've had this historic inequity between African-American communities and the white community makes it even worse. So university towns, we have a world-class university here, which we're all proud of and love, but it brings in lots of money. It brings in lots of really bright people who are paid, you know, market-appropriate wages for the wonderful things they do. We have researchers and faculty and administrators. But what that ends up doing is it ends up making the city more unequal, and income inequality is certainly an issue. But many university towns face this, and so I think there's lots of good work that's going on about this. The first thing is that there's all of this focus on the fact that we have inequality. 25% of families in this city struggle with the cost of basic survival expenses, plus the costs associated with working, such as transportation and childcare. The university recently commissioned a working group to help address some of these from the university's side, and I believe there's a real commitment on the part of the administration there to make a difference. And so I'm optimistic that that we're going to things will improve. The living wage that the university just put together, just put forward, makes a lot of sense too, and that will help as well.
You know, the New York Times ProPublica report on the achievement gap between the races in Charlottesville City schools alarmed educators, students, parents like me, and residents alike. Dr. Adkins and the school board and everyone in the school division have tried to address this problem. What can you bring the city council to help solve it?
I think that the first thing to know about the schools, from my understanding and talking with people on the school board, is that our facilities have not received the level of capital improvements and upgrades that they need. They're essentially well-maintained, but they're older facilities. The school board is calling for a combined middle school for 6th, 7th, and 8th grades, and the 5th grades would go back down to the elementary schools. The idea is that would, in addition to being able to invest in a middle school facility that is appropriate and wholesome and a good place to learn, it would reduce the number of transitions that students have to go through, and so from one school to another. And so that would improve educational outcomes. I guess the thing that I would say about the piece with the New York Times article, like so many things, as in with policing, it is a challenge. We face so many issues in our community and this nation as a whole, And school teachers can only do so much. You know, one of the things we can help the school system with is to have more affordable housing so school teachers can live close by. So these things are all connected. The other thing I believe is that we should trust the school board, and we should trust those administrators that are on it, working with it. I've been to the school board meeting, and I was impressed with the level of thoughtfulness in laying out this new proposal. I think that they're thinking in terms of equity. They're thinking in terms of how we minimize these, like the Quest program, how we minimize the tracking that occurs. And they're doing this in a thoughtful way. So part of my approach would be to trust those who are experts on the topic.
Well, thanks, Brian. This is a great conversation. We need to take a short break. And we're back. I'm Jeff Leonard, and I'm co-hosting with Bob McAdams a 94.7 WPVC election special interview with City Council candidate Brian Pinkston. Bob and Brian, we're talking about the issues.
And we got another tough issue for you, Brian. Having health care available when you need it is just a necessity for everybody in our area and everywhere else. Lowering the high cost of health insurance is another need for many people in the city. What role do you see the city taking to address the real concern of people receiving health care when they need it?
Yes, this is an incredibly complicated question. You know, those of us blessed to work for a place like the university have great health care options. But even with that, it's interesting. My daughter broke her foot recently, and when I looked at the bill, I was like, holy smokes, this is really incredible. And so people that lack that, it is a justice issue and a compassion issue. The remarkable thing that's happening at a national level is this push to roll back any sort of what I would call solidarity with people that have health issues. And it's not clear to me the best way forward. We obviously need stronger leadership in Richmond, and I think we're getting that with more Democrats that are committed to this. You see with the Medicaid expansion, these things. And it's important to remember that something like Medicaid expansion happened because activists and because political folks got involved in the political process a year ago and fought to have the House of Delegates have more Democrats there. So my only point there is that elections do matter, and they matter on really important things like health care. In terms of what the city can do, there are things that the city can do. There's the Map to Health report that was done by the Thomas Jefferson Regional Health District that talks about, you know, ways to do more for exercise and better foods in the schools and things like that. We have the Charlottesville Free Clinic, which is a wonderful thing as well. But this is a really significant challenge, and it's not clear to me how much leverage the city has in terms of really being able to improve it. I am optimistic that the state government is going to do more to make these insurance companies cooperate, so we'll have to see.
Now, for people who have mental illness, getting care is even more of a challenge. You know, there are limits to insurance coverage, and the lack of professionals in the field mean that many people with mental health problems just go untreated. What should the city do to help people with mental illness receive care?
Yeah, and the interesting thing on this, in fact, is that so many mental health providers in our community actually refuse to take insurance, so it becomes even more of a class issue. Mental health is such a remarkable thing because you can look at someone from the outside and they look perfectly fine, but what's going on the inside, it can be completely completely different. And it really does need to be something that we think through in all of our decisions about how we as a community work together. As I said, I was on the board of Region 10, and so much of what they focus on is mental health. Practically speaking, what I would love for the city to do, assuming the budget would allow it, is to increase the amount of the contribution. So there are six municipalities or jurisdictions that fund Region 10 Community Services Board, all the way from Green to Nelson, Pluvanna, Louisa, in Charlottesville, in Albemarle, each contributes a certain amount based off a formula that was set in place a number of years ago. I would hope that Charlottesville and Albemarle County would increase the amount of money that they pay to Region 10 to be able to support all the good work that Region 10 does. Region 10 has everything from if there's a psychiatric issue in the emergency room at the hospital, they respond to that. They have counselors in the schools that work with children in the schools. They have homes for people with substance use disorder. It's remarkable the amount of work that they do. And one thing that people may not know is that Medicaid expansion was a really great thing for this, for the community as a whole, for the state as a whole. But it changed the way funding worked for community services boards. And so sometimes funding is even more of a challenge because the way reimbursements are done from the state has changed. So I really would hope that the local municipalities would find a way to contribute more to the CSB, because that is sort of the ultimate backstop where so many of these things come together. And they do such great work, and Region 10 is such a wonderful organization.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's Charlottesville City Council Candidate Forum. I'm Jeff Leonard. In studio today is Brian Pinkston. Brian, the mental illness leads us to the next question. The criminal justice system. The superintendent of the regional jail has said 50% of all people in jail suffer from some form of mental illness, and 80% have substance abuse disorder. What changes in the criminal justice system are needed, and what role can the city play to address these needs?
Right. It's remarkable to me how, and it's not just in Virginia, but it's an issue throughout the country. These three strikes, your outlaws, minimum mandatory sentencing. There's somewhere along the way we have lost sight of the purpose of the criminal justice system. It's not to enact revenge, and it's not to sort of grind people down to the dust who have committed crimes. It should be for people to pay their debt to society, to be rehabilitated, and to go on to more profitable, productive lives. And what happens with these incarceration rates is it's, first of all, they affect disproportionately minorities. But you also have children and families and networks of people that are affected when a person gets caught up in like a petty drug offense. So we have these laws that are so onerous. And one of the things that we really need to do is in some groups like Virginia Organizing, for instance, have lobbied to have the amount of shoplifting that counts as a felony, I think was, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was like $150 or something, and they got that raised to $500. That's a huge difference. Another thing that happens is that people will have a minor driving offense and have to pay a fine and be unable to pay the fine because of poverty. And so then they end up driving without a license, and these things can turn into just sort of a downward spiral for people. I think that folks that sort of have a basic income and, you know, sort of know their way around, and, you know, white middle class folks, we often have a hard time understanding the just structural limitations that people that are in poverty deal with. We think that, you know, if you get in trouble with the law, you can get a lawyer, or you can, you know, pay the fine and life moves on. But that's not the case for people that don't have the means to deal with it. So I think a large part of this has to do with Richmond. I do think that there are things that we can do here and have been done. I have a friend, Albie LaFave, a shout out to him, who was very instrumental in getting the mental health docket set up in the city. That's a great program. It helps people that have mental health issues that got caught up in the criminal justice system to have their sentences mitigated if they work with the judge and others in the system. And that's been a wonderful program. Those are the sorts of progressive, thoughtful things we need to do to actually help people get better and help society improve. The Offender Restoration Group, or they call it, is another great nonprofit that works to help people get back into the communities. We really need to have this think carefully about the balance between public safety on the one hand and restoring people on the other. I think that in general, our country has swung too far to the public safety side. Public safety is important, obviously, but it's about managing risks. And I think that we're managing risks by locking people up. And not only is that unjust, it's expensive.
You know, statistics reveal another issue with the criminal justice system, and that is that of systemic racism. It goes on from the police stops to prosecutors to probation to incarceration. Whites have a clear advantage over people of color. What can the city do to make sure all members of our community can trust the justice is equally administered by our police officers, prosecutors, judges, and prison staff?
Yes, I went to the Civilian Review Board that's just been set up by the city council that came out of the August 11th and 12th events the soul searching that happened after that. I went to one of the meetings recently. I was very impressed by the level of competence of the people that were leading that, the members on the board. Contrary to some people's opinions, I think that there's not a desire to be punitive towards the police. There is really just a desire to have more oversight, and I think that's perfectly reasonable. What impressed me the most was the research they were doing on other communities that face the same problem and trying to find good models for Charlottesville. I'm optimistic that they will. I think that we should also realize that we cannot expect policemen and women to fix all of society's ills. They have a certain role, and it's one thing to complain about policing, but if your car breaks down on the side of the road or you have an issue, the first thing you do is call the police. And most policemen and women care to serve. That's what they're there for. And so I think one of the biggest things that we can do to support our police is to pay them well, to do what we can to recruit and retain them. I think that demonizing the police, in particular individual policemen and women on the street, is not a good thing and does not help the overall cause of having a better, just society.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC Charlottesville City Council Candidate Forum. I'm Bob McAdams. Now, Brian, recent reports from scientists tell us that the climate change crisis is much worse than previously understood, and young people are condemning the lack of action by older people, and the older people are the ones in positions of power. How should Charlottesville respond to the worsening global warming crisis?
The first thing that I had on my list here was to vote out the people that deny climate change. It's still really remarkable to me with all of the evidence that's piled up. Someone with a basic understanding of thermodynamics should have no problem understanding what's going on with the Earth's climate. Just because you can't predict, how everything is going to, whether you're going to have half a degree or this, 2 degrees and so forth and so on, makes no difference to me. When you think about all the fossil fuels that have been burned since the Industrial Revolution and the effect that that would have in terms of heating the planet. So I think what this points to largely in a more large context is the fact that so many people, in particular our political class, aren't focused on thinking carefully through issues from a very thoughtful perspective, and are being pulled in directions that serve corporate interests. I know that on this radio station I'm preaching to the choir, but I think that that's really important when we talk with others in the community or our friends and neighbors, to really break these things down into science and to break these things down into evidence. And we should never give up on facts. There's this tendency now, particularly with social media and our current president, to give up on facts. We should not. Facts are real, and data is real. So in terms of what we can do here in our city, again, this is such a large problem. A lot of what we're going to have to focus on, unfortunately, I think, is resilience. I think that there are certainly specific things that we can do We can, the university has staff that's done just a fantastic job about mapping the university's carbon footprint and nitrogen footprint. They have a very extensive plan in place to manage those things and to reduce them. The projects that I work on there, we're required to follow very stringent environmental guidelines. Those things are also being rolled out in the city and the county. There's a lot of good collaboration that's going on those scores. But there are practical things that the city can do, like retro-commissioning for their HVAC systems, which basically means going back and make sure things are set up right, that you're not wasting energy and water and how you're cooling and heating your buildings. We can make sure that our equipment fleet and our transportation fleets meet basic requirements for sustainability. We again need to think about in terms of resilience. If we start having the seas over and the ocean over in the tidewater area push and begin to displace people, this is not outside of the realm of possibility. Think about the effect that's going to have on our housing situation. I come back to storm sewers. Doing developments, major developments, where you put in the storm sewers, you know, within 100 yards of where you live, but tie it into 75-year-old piping, that's not a sustainable solution. So these things are important, and it really does get down, I think, at the city level to very granular choices that we make in terms of doing the right thing about the choices that we make on everything from procurement to the fleet that we have to how we run our facilities.
What we also need to do is change our patterns of transportation to reduce carbon emissions. But the transportation system must be highly effective in order to be accepted by the public. What do you propose that the city do to meet these demanding needs?
And it's very interesting when you talk about transportation in the city. It's such a particular issue for people, and particularly people of color rely on it to for their daily life to get back and forth to work. I think it's something that, for me in particular, quite frankly, I need to do more thinking and research on. I'm not sure that the answer is just more buses or more bus routes, although that might be part of the solution. I think better coordination with the university could be part of the solution. I think as well just having, if we were to shift to a model where transportation was just sort of, public transportation was built into the daily life of our community and not just sort of an extra thing that people that, you know, can't afford cars use, if that paradigm was flipped, I think that then we would begin to see a real reliance on the public transportation system. There's also a lot of really good work that's going on in terms of bike paths and trails and things like that, and throughout the entire region. And I think that that's, there's a lot of good work going on there. And those are, I love when you start talking about win-win situations. So when you do that, you're tackling climate change. You're also, it costs less money for people to get around. You don't have to invest in roads. And it also helps people that, like I mentioned earlier, lose their licenses and have no way to get from to work. If you have reliable pathways for people to get throughout the city, that makes a huge difference. And there is so much good work that's going on. There are a number of organizations that are involved in that. And
So future trends point to more people living in urban areas with high density populations. This means more living units within a fixed area of the city. Studies and practical experience show that humans need green space for their well-being and to keep the community sane. How can the city balance these needs together?
You know, land use is really the heart, one of the core responsibilities. Managing land use is one of the core responsibilities of a city council. And it's also such a tricky thing because people don't want a major development coming right into their backyard when they've lived in an area for a long time. That's not an unreasonable thing to want. On the other hand, we are going to need, I believe, more dense living. You're going to see this across the world. Cities are the future. That's where people come to meet and mingle and get educated and start families and do commerce. And people have pointed out that our zoning laws are set up here for more sort of suburban living, and we need to move more towards an urban mindset. I think there's lots of good work that's going on with the Planning Commission and the new comprehensive plan that's out there. The crucial thing, though, when I'm out canvassing and talking to people in the neighborhoods, all of this becomes very personal very quickly. There's going to have to be a level of compromise and dialogue on all parties, which is sort of a, you know, a simple thing to say, but is true. The other thing I would say is the difference between real density and pseudo-density. So some of these new developments that are going in, these infill developments, are huge homes, and they're packed in very tightly, and yet, you know, you'll have a family of five living there. So that's not what I would call genuine density. So I think thinking about that is important. I also think that parks are important in saving green space. I was just over, I've been canvassing in Fry Springs. There's a proposed development over there that's really made the upset the neighbors there incredibly upset, and I understand why. They're wanting to take over the company that's building is wanting to, you know, just cut down essentially a small forest and take over land that is used, you know, it's a good place for water to go and be. It's just a lovely place. So I think if we had been as a city more forward thinking, this is an example about that piece of property, that could be a wonderful park. So I don't think there are simple answers for this question, and you run up really quickly with people who have different, I won't say agendas, but different perspectives on what makes the most sense. And being thoughtful and open to dialogue and not close-minded on this particular topic is incredibly important.
Well, thanks, Brian. We need to interrupt this discussion and take another short break. And we're back. I'm Jeff Leonard. I'm co-hosting with Bob McAdams, a 94.7 WPVC election special interview with Charlottesville City Council candidate Brian Pinkston. Bob and Brian, we've got one more segment to talk about the issues.
Brian, 2017 was just a year of turmoil, and people showed their distrust, their anger, their frustration with City Council in long, emotional meetings. What do you see can be done to restore trust and confidence and good order in the relations between City Council and the public?
Right, this is such an important topic. There is a desire on the part of many people that I meet in the city for a return to normalcy on City Council and the way meetings are conducted. But I think that we need to be careful using that word. First of all, there's a new normal, and also the old normal for many people, people of color, was not receptive or helpful or generous or kind, at least the way it was perceived. And so we really need to be thoughtful about that topic, about that question. On the one hand, City Council meetings are a place for members of the public to come and air things that concern them. On the other hand, it's a place for business to be done, the business of the city. And not everyone can come to City Council meetings. It is something that concerns me when I talk to people out in the neighborhoods who've basically said, I don't go to City Council meetings anymore or even pay attention because it's such a raucous affair. That concerns me. People are disengaging. And so I would say that as a community, we really need to think about what we think is appropriate behavior and language, realizing that voices that have been marginalized are now having a chance to speak. I also feel like that people like myself, folks of privilege, folks, you know, that come from a more affluent background, we need to take the initiative to be good listeners. We need to take the initiative to be thoughtful in how we conduct our affairs. It's very important to, in communication, a large part of communication is not just what you intend, but how you come across and how you're perceived. And you can't always control all of that, but you can be careful about it. There was a recent piece on NPR about civility and how that's become such a buzzword or a bad word in Charlottesville. I think perhaps we do need to use a different word than civility. and they mean different things to different people. I mean, the notion of civility per se really has to do with respectable behavior, and what counts as respectable behavior is different for different people. So what I want us to get to, Heather Hill has talked about mutual respect. I like that idea. But I think the main thing to keep in mind is that people have different ways of processing information. People have different life histories, different life stories. What may be a good way of communicating for one person is not for another. And so, to me, courtesy and kindness and generosity and loving your neighbor as yourself means that when you talk or when you listen, you try to be empathetic about how the other person would listen or talk.
At times, Brian, members of the city council just didn't seem to get along very well. Mm-hmm. And that makes working effectively, as well as the relations with the public, even harder. If you're elected to serve on city council, what will you do to improve the working relations among city councilors themselves?
Right. I think that one of the things that's important to know, and I learned this was on the I was on the Board of Region 10, is the unintended consequences of open meeting laws. Open meeting laws, sunshine laws, or whatever they're going to call them, are really important. It forces transparency. But the thing that people may not realize is that you can't just go out to, you know, Denny's or someplace and talk about business with other councilors and try to come up with solutions outside of the public eye. And so what that means is you have to have these disagreements in public, which can be messy. There was this desire to have a retreat last fall that didn't end well, apparently. And so it's challenging to talk about interpersonal relationships when you've got people live tweeting what you're doing. So I think what that means is that you have to be able and willing to work on a person-to-person basis to develop credibility with each other. It also is why the role of the mayor is so important. The mayor's role, like the chair of a board, is to sort of go around and help the folks on council get a sense between meetings of where things are and how to achieve consensus, or at least when you come to meetings, know where people stand and kind of guide the conversation. So that's a really important thing to keep in mind in terms of the role of mayor. I also think that, you know, we've had, quite frankly, some situations in the last couple of years where agendas of a personal nature, sometimes well-meant, sometimes perhaps not. I won't comment on that. But it's one thing to advocate for policies. That's important for city councilors. But if you're so agenda-driven where you've just, I'm going to focus on these three things, or I'm going to focus on my own political ambition or whatever, council is supposed to be more than that. It's about doing the business of the people of the city. And that should always be the first thing that people have in mind.
Well, the fundamental structure of city government, you know, five part-time elected councilors plus an unelected full-time city manager staff, would challenge the ability of any group of people to work together effectively. What do you imagine the city government to do to work together better or to accomplish more? And what role does the state government have in this local dysfunction?
Yeah, I think that it is important for people to realize that we do have a city manager form of government. And there does seem to have been more sort of direct engagement by individual councilors with city staff than perhaps is appropriate. So we need the new city manager to be competent and effective. We need to hold people accountable in the city government. There's a lot of the issues that we face that just come down to pure execution and operation. And those things need to be fixed. Obviously, this is a Dillon rule state, and so we are often really hampered about what we can do as a municipality with respect. We need the General Assembly's blessing and approval. We can continue to lobby for more freedom on that. I think that we need to trust staff as much as possible. I think we should have fewer consultants and be willing to sort of take risks, given the expertise of the people on council and city staff. And just ensuring competency on staff.
What areas do you think Charlottesville could best collaborate with Albemarle, UVA, and other neighboring counties?
Right, I think there's a lot of good collaboration going on right now, which is encouraging. I went to a recent meeting where the supervisors and the councilors were meeting. I think that there should be, and I also believe that there's a lot of things going on at the level of staff where conversations and coordination is happening. I think that there should be more of that, though. I think that if they met more frequently, that would not be a bad thing. I also think that we need to have fewer petty fights, fewer lawsuits about things like Ragged Mountain Reservoir and so forth. I think that coordinating with the university is incredibly important. This recent working group that issued a report, I think everyone should read it. There's a real desire, I'm convinced, on the part of the university to have better relationships with the city, and that report's a great place to start.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC Charlottesville City Council Forum interview with Brian Pinkston. I'm Bob McAdams. Now, Brian, you're running for city council. How do you describe your candidacy, your campaign to voters in the moment or two you might have with them at the door or in an elevator?
Yeah, so I start with the fact that I'm a project manager, and I've been doing project management work for 30 years. And project managers basically bring people, resources, and ideas together to get stuff done. You can't be a project manager. Doesn't matter what field you're in, construction or IT or whatever, you can't be a good project manager if you don't know how to listen to people, if you don't know how to find common ground, find solutions. No solution is ever perfect. You can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And that's what I tell people. I also tell people that thinking in terms of the common good is something we have got to get back to in every conversation that we have. And people are responsive to that. People believe in the idea of the common good. They want to support that, and they want leaders that are going to advocate for that.
Now, the June 11th primary is coming up quickly, and to get elected, first, you got to win the nomination to become one of three Democratic candidates for city council, and then you also need to be one of three winners in the November 5th general election. What's your plan, and what organization are you building to accomplish that?
Yeah, just briefly, it's door knocking. We're targeting people that vote in the primaries. You know, it's like 3,500 to 4,000 people, and I'm knocking on their doors. It really does in the city come down to a candidate having a face-to-face conversation with voters, which is cool. I love that part. You have to raise a lot of money. Not a lot, but you have to raise money, and I hate that part of the job. That's the worst part of being. We're getting volunteers to help us with canvassing as well. We will be doing phone banking and so forth. And then there are the various forums that the neighborhoods are putting on. I'm looking forward to those. We've already had one forum with the Laura Pack, and that was a great event. So that's a way to get in front of people. We'll be doing mailers at some point soon, and we'll also have some media, radio, and so forth. We're also doing, of course, social media, which is, I'm glad I have a young person doing my campaign managing, because I can't make heads or tails of it.
So every campaign needs to pay for the basics to get their candidate's message out to as many people as possible. How are you raising funds to help pay for those basics in your campaign?
Well, everyone tells you that you start with your friends and your family, and that's what I've done. And we built, I've just spoken to a lot of people I know who've committed, you know, given smaller gifts, and those are adding up to bigger gifts. And then as you move along through the process, you find people that have been committed to Democratic politics for years, are really concerned about the city. Then, you know, you make your case to them, and they eventually will contribute. But it's mostly smaller gifts that you hope add up to something significant at the end. That's basically what it comes down to, is making requests for people. And I used to think, I didn't really appreciate the point of, one of the points of donating to a political campaign is to think about it in terms of investing in leadership. Taxes are a way that you invest in your city. But if you want to invest in the leadership of your city, then I would suggest giving to a candidate of your choice, because that's how that works. It does take money to do these things. It doesn't happen in a vacuum.
So what's the best way for people to get in touch with your campaign to learn more about you, or to volunteer or donate?
The best way is our website and then Facebook. So my website, it's Pinkston for Seville. So my pink like the color, forseville.org. And then you can find us on Facebook and Twitter as well. We have the Act Blue set up there if you're used to using that to donate. And we do need volunteers to multiply our efforts. So, yeah, those are the best ways to get in touch with us. Or you can just call me directly. My phone number is 882-1038. I'd love to hear from you.
So, unfortunately, we've run out of time. Ryan, thank you for spending an hour with us and our WPVC listeners. This is one in a series of election special interviews with candidates in our area seeking the nomination for city councilor, county supervisor, delegate, and state senator in the June 11th primary. Each of the interviews will be available on podcast on our website, 947wpvc.org, after they have been broadcast. We thank Brian Pinkston for giving us his time so that you, our listeners, can make the best choice of nominees for city council. Next week, we'll have city council candidate Bob Fenwick in our studio for an election special interview. Thanks for listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
You've been listening to the 94.7 WPVC Election Special Candidates Forum. The program is brought to you with support from Rebecca's Natural Food and Hamilton's at First and Main. Join us again next Saturday at 11 as we talk to yet another candidate for local office in Virginia's 2019 off-year elections. You can hear this program again or suggest questions for upcoming guests at 947WPVC.org or link to it through our Facebook page. Thanks for listening.